It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Ben Domenech. We're back with another edition, boys and girls, of the Ben Domenech Podcast, brought to you by Fox News. You can check out all of our podcasts at foxnewspodcast.com, and I hope that you will rate, review, and subscribe to this one. I had a conversation recently with Linda McMahon, who obviously had served in the Trump administration in a couple of different roles, and then came out of it into the America First Policy Institute, where she is the head of their board, essentially a group of policymakers who were from the Trump administration and are trying to build a new massive think tank that takes on his perspective and the perspective of other America First politicians as things go forward. The think tank landscape is a difficult one to navigate in Washington, D.C. at this moment because there's a lot of large institutions that have huge budgets and huge buildings, but perhaps are not as influential as they once were in so many different ways. The AFPI is the new kid on the block in a lot of ways. We talk about both her work there, her work with workforce development and other aspects of her Trump administration tenure. But we also talk, of course, about wrestling, her role in the family business that the McMahons ran, and how the WWE has changed the way that we view our culture in a lot of different ways. One thing that I wanted to be sure to mention and recommend to you all is that if you haven't read it, you should read Ryan Holiday's book, Conspiracy, which is one of the best, I think, depictions of how wrestling became a major factor in terms of media developments in the past decade or so. Linda McMahon, coming up next.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Stay on top of the latest news and information from Fox News. Listen and download the Fox News Hourly Update on your time. The trending stories you need anytime you want it. Listen and download now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
Linda McMahon, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today.
It's great to be with you, Ben. Thanks for having me on.
I want to talk to you about a number of different things. But first off, I just want to ask you a little bit about your non-political life and the family business that you've been a part of for so long. In recent years, wrestling terminology, it seems like, has gone mainstream. People know the different terms. Some people, they know what a shoot is. They know kind of the different terminology and the different expressions for heel turns and the like. And obviously, you know, some of the biggest actors in America today are former pro wrestlers. What do you think about the situation of seeing everything that came out of really your family business turn into something that is such a culturally dominant phenomenon?
Well, Ben, clearly it's very pleasing and exciting to see that. But we always thought that, you know, we were part of the American mainstream culture. I mean, it didn't matter if it was in the United States or if we traveled abroad, there was someone who always had a wrestling story. So I think it gets down to the fact that everyday people, you know, experience things in their lives. Like, for instance, I had a gentleman who told me one time when my grandmother came over and she couldn't speak any English. She came over from Italy. She couldn't speak any English, but she had to watch wrestling every single week. She had to watch WWF at the time. And she really learned a lot of words, you know, by watching wrestling, but she was always so enthusiastic about it. I had a mother 2 weeks ago who said to me, boy, I had such a great time taking my children to a wrestling event, a WWE event that was in Texas, and had no idea what I was going to see, but my son's birthday had come up and this is what he wanted to do. And so we took some friends and got some tickets. She said, I never had such a good time. She said so many families were there and such a diverse crowd, you know, at the arena watching the event. So I really believe that so much of WWE's success is because it is really grassroots. And you go, WWE goes into the community, so the live event is there. But it works with, you know, children's hospitals. It works with organizations for non-bullying. And so it really does become part of, I think, America's, you know, everyday activities. And I think that's why you've seen so much of it, you know, having been adopted.
In a sense, do you feel like what you all did with building up wrestling as a national phenomenon kind of presaged the current cultural dynamic and the embrace of everything that has to do with superheroes? These really are kind of real life comic book characters, if you get right down to it, you know, superheroes you can actually see in kind of that, you know, mythic or legend way, especially for young boys. Was that something that was in your mind as you were going through the experience of building this company, or was it something that kind of came to fruition organically?
Well, first of all, let me say that I had absolutely nothing to do with building the characters. I was never the creative side of the company or the business at all. Mine was more focused on the business side, and some of the characters that were developed, I was often surprised at. I mean, for one, The Undertaker. I mean, that's just a character that when it first, you know, came on board, just was not something I would ever have thought of in a zillion years. It became one of our most popular characters. But, you know, then other characters who are larger than life. But, you know, if you think back, way back to the early comics and Superman and Aquaman and all of those, they were around for a long time. So WWE is a real blend of kind of that superhero character, but also, you know, the real life personality as well.
How hard is it to work with people who are creatively, they have to be all over the place in terms of thinking of new ideas, you know, trying to throw spaghetti at the wall and come up with characters and things like that, while you have to handle the actual numbers to make everything work?
Well, you know, it's very interesting because WWE, if you think about it, at live events, and there, you know, there was a time when we had one or two live events every single night, but it's not that many now, but still live events, three or four a week with each brand. And you have a live marketing audience right there to give you thumbs up or thumbs down. I mean, if you introduce a character that's supposed to get boos and they get laughs, well, you know, you're not on the right track. So it's really an advantage of having, you know, real-time marketing info and input, in addition to now all of the technology that's available that the WWE fans bring to, you know, the arenas and to the stadiums for the events. But you really, you can get feedback really quickly on what's working and what's not and what storylines, because, you know, the writing that goes into the soap opera drama that is played out every week is really the hook that keeps people coming back all the time, plus the incredible in-ring action of what I believe are some of the best athletes and stars in the world, because they, you know, it's 52 weeks a year. There's no season to what WWE does. And these incredibly talented men and women who are in the ring are actually kind of acting out that storyline and with their on mic and on camera work as well. So it's incredibly impressive. It's so impressive to see what they do. They're not out there with a teleprompter. You know,
no.
They're working on their storylines and whatever, you know, script, and a lot of them can go off script, but as long as they are, you know, within the boundaries of that. But they're just amazing, amazing performers. My hat goes off to them all the time.
It's a theater, it's a circus, it's death defying stunts. And so, I mean, the combination of that is just incredible in terms of, especially, you know, if it's viewed through, you know, the eyes of a younger fan. And I just think that it's such a fascinating development in terms of how popular and how sustained that popularity has been. One more question before I move to less serious topics like politics. Developments or anything that has been a storyline or a character in the past couple of years that stood out to you as being something that either surprised you for how popular it was, or that you've really cottoned on to as just being, oh, I'm impressed with this. I'm impressed with this development.
You know, I can't pick out one over the other, and that's not, I'm not dodging your question. It's very interesting because when the writers, especially when Vince was writing some of the storylines, and I would say, okay, well, tell me what's going to happen. He says, no, I don't want to tell you. I want to get your reaction to it. I want to get your reaction to it live when it's really happening, and to see, you know, if you're impressed by it, if you're disappointed by it, if you're surprised by it. And I think some of the market studies that we had done over the years indicated that one of the things that the WWE fans liked the most is when they were surprised, when they thought they had it figured out, and then came time for sort of the payoff or the big reveal, and it absolutely fooled them. And they loved that. They really liked the surprise. So for me personally, it's all a surprise when I sit down and watch.
It's one of the things that's in common with the great television age that we're in, when people think that they figured out the storyline and then something veers in the opposite direction.
And I have to give, you know, such incredible credit to the writers and the performers at WWE, because as I said, they do this 52 weeks a year. Mm-hmm. And if you think there's live programming on USA Network, 3 hours on Monday night, 2 hours on Fox on Friday night, so that's 5 hours of live programming, plus all the other interstitial programming that gets done. It's an amazing amount of content that gets developed.
It was, as I said, a family business. Tell me about the challenges of running a family business in America today, in an era in which it seems like marketplaces are dominated by global multinational corporations that are often faceless and don't have any of that kind of family element to what they do.
You know, I'd like to take it back even maybe a little step further, Ben, because a family business, if you think about how Vince and I just got started, we really were a small business. Mm-hmm. And small businesses, just like today, some of the things that they're facing, I mean, when we first started, we didn't have collateral. We didn't own bricks and mortar. And any monies that we would like to borrow to get us from some events or some months to the next were really based on cash flow. So we were a small business operating in a world of where you really needed a lot of collateral, et cetera. But a family business, I think, is also, it brings its own challenges. First of all, a husband and wife who were working together, you know, every day, and then go home at night. And so your business partners, your spouses, and then your children come into the mix as well. And but I think basically for Vince and me personally, it worked out incredibly well, because all of the things that he did so unbelievably well, which was all of the creative and the marketing and all of that, I could not do. And I've said that, you know, many people could do my job, you know, every day, but not his particular kind of, I really do believe it's marketing genius. And so, you know, we came to work in different cars. We came and left at different times. And so it worked out really well for us. But I do think there is a family dynamic when you do disagree. You might have disagreed on, maybe if it's not WWE, but you disagree on what the marketing aspect is going to be, or what investments you make for goods and services and products. And does that then affect how you are as a family, if it's a husband and wife, or if it's siblings who were in a family business? So it does bring those dynamics sometimes, I think, which a lot of businesses don't survive.
I hear something when I go out and speak in front of audiences about from small business owners across the country today, that's very discouraging. They basically come to me and they say, I really want to disconnect from the China supply chain. I don't want to have to be part of it. But if I do that, my business is going to go under. I can't afford to manufacture whatever, you know, goods that I'm making, you know, or a specific part that is key to what I'm creating, if I disconnect from China, even if politically that's something that I'd like to achieve. I know that this is something that's important to you too. What can we do to make sure that small businesses in America, which, you know, are interconnected with all of these different nations around the world, that they have the ability to turn to supply chains that come from either, you know, closer places to us like Canada and Mexico, or to nations that are more allied with our interests, such as India, for instance, or perhaps other nations in South Asia, as opposed to being dependent on the Chinese Communist Party and everything that they produce?
Well, I think it's important and incumbent upon us to be able to direct those small businesses, to provide them with the information. I think that's one of the things that the SBA certainly tried to do. I know that's one of the things we tried to do when I was there, to connect them with trade organizations to see where it is that they could get the best supply chains, and also to encourage them and to help provide funding for those small businesses to themselves go over to some of the countries that might have the product that they need, and to cut deals with them while they were there so that they could bypass a lot of the middlemen. And then you have to work on, then it becomes a supply chain, not just the production, but the supply chain. But it, there is a way to do it, but it's all about information, and it's difficult, when it, especially when it's just easier to connect already with some of the you know, the trade that is available and get in. But I think ultimately the answer is we just need to manufacture more here in our country. If we could do that, and when I was at SBA and I was visiting a couple of small businesses, and I was, one of them was a tractor company, and I asked him, I said, you're buying these tractors, you know, from China, and you're selling them here in the United States. And I said, so what's happened? Why can't you buy them here in the United States? And he first talked about, you know, it was much cheaper. The supply chain, although sometimes took a little longer because it was coming, he said, but let me tell you what's interesting and what's happening. He said, China is building such inferior products, trying to rip off what we do. He said, I have expanded my business now into tractor repair. He said, so I am repairing the tractors that didn't come here from the United States, but I am repairing them now. And what my customers are finding is that they are better off in the long run to buy their tractors here in the United States that are made in the United States, because they're better made and it doesn't cost them as much to keep them in repair. So I heard those kind of stories, and I think that's incredibly important for us to remember.
You know, just similarly experiencing this with a young child, what we found very typically was that the Chinese products that we would order, or Chinese made products that we would order, would be fine, but they would break very quickly or very easily. Whereas the American products that we would order, or products that were from, you know, Canada or Europe or the like, they would be more expensive, but they would actually last longer and they wouldn't fall apart.
Sure.
And so that seems to be something that is true across a lot of the marketplace today. What can we do to help establish in the American consumer's mind more that buying American isn't just an act of patriotism? It's also in their financial interest to do so, because the products that they're going to get are going to run longer, serve them better, you know, and ultimately have repairers and people who can support them here who will be more responsive and able to deal with any problems that arise.
Well, I think really a lot of that comes down to, you know, product availability. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it, you know, is the marketing promotion that companies here, you know, in the United States have to take on and have to assume some of that. But as more and more consumers experience what you and I have just been discussing, they will be looking for the better made and better quality product, even if it does cost a little bit more. But at the same time, I think we have to really work to make sure that we have our fair trade deals in place so that the cost of bringing those goods in does get higher and higher, so that there is competition here in America for those products. And we really need to focus on that.
Tell me a little bit about the workforce development side of things. We've been through this period now where, under the pandemic, you know, because of a lot of the money that was flowing out of Washington, it incentivized a situation where people were essentially being paid not to work. They, you know, were dropping out of jobs that they had held or not moving forward because they were worried about losing access to the benefits that they were receiving from the government. When it comes to boosting this economy, which, you know, regardless of the aspect of it that's affecting you negatively, Americans view very negatively in this moment, whether it's because of inflation, whether it's because of the stock market, whether it's because of, you know, a lot of shrunk capacity or problems with supply chains or the like, there's negative viewpoints there. How can we turn that around in terms of developing a workforce that is, you know, both prepared for the challenges that we have and also doesn't have this massive incentive in terms of government funding to just stay out of work?
Well, I think that's the first issue. We have to make sure that we're not paying people to stay home, you know, and providing those same benefits for them that they could get if they were, you know, coming to work. I think there was a certain period of time. I think a lot of this did come in under COVID, and I respected the fact that we got out, you know, the PP, and I'll never get it right, PPP or PVE program that came out first under the Trump administration. I was not at SBA then, but I do know that that was very helpful. In spite of some of the fraud that took place, it was incredibly helpful for many small businesses who would have lost their employees to keep them, you know, for, you know, for 2 or 3 months.
And we had to get and who had been shut down by the government.
Right. And we had, just what I was about to say. We were just and we had to get the economy back open and we had to get places back up and running. But then we shouldn't have continued, you know, that that outreach and that handout, if you will. We should have then focused on getting people back to work. And people became, I think they sort of like staying at home also and working from their computers and things like that. And there are companies then who, I'm rambling a little bit, but there are also companies who then made it mandatory that you had to come back in for X number of days a week. And I think that's so important because you have to experience the culture of the business, you know, that you're working in. And it's really important to interact, you know, with your fellow employees. But, you know, there's a lot in the question that you posed of getting people back to work, but then and how are we training people? A lot of those people were laid off and employers found, well, I don't really need that, you know, those that many people to come back and to do the jobs that they're doing. So how do we retrain and reskill those people, you know, who are out of work? And I think our community colleges can be very helpful in doing that. I think, you know, we can go all the way back, you know, now into our whole education system, you know, that we have in our country. When we got rid of SHOP and we got rid of a lot of those technical applications in high schools and kids didn't graduate with any of those skills. So I think our workforce development has gone from getting away from a skills base to more of the 4-year college type of environment and recognition. And I think that we need to now look at our economy needs skill-based workers. We need artisans. We need the people who can do those things. And they can then skill up to understand how to do that and employ the technology to be in a lot of the manufacturing firms. And so I think that, you know, entrepreneurs can really look at how they can be involved in training a lot of these programs and working with the local community colleges to say, these are the jobs that I need. This is the, these are the programs that you need to teach. This is what you need to do so that when these people graduate, they have jobs to go to because this is what we need, you know, in the business world. I think it's so incredibly important that we have our businesses working with not only our community colleges, technical colleges, but also with our 4-year colleges to turn out the kind of graduates that are skilled to be in whatever kind of workforce that there is at that point.
I want to go out with a kind of a larger philosophical question. You're a businesswoman, you're a mother, you're a grandmother. There's basically been a trend in recent years of among a lot of different women, both, you know, on the right and to some degree on the left, who have been very critical of the existing circumstances regarding incentives that were put in place for them to either remain in the workforce long term or to be more reluctant to have children or to form a family. They have become more open about criticizing policies that were put in place that seemed more designed on making them good workers than necessarily allowing for a level of income in a two-parent home or the like, where they could have it all to a certain extent. What needs to change about the way that America approaches these policies, either from a political standpoint or a business standpoint, that will allow women to not feel forced into a dynamic where they end up trying to form a family later and later, as we see them do statistically, when, you know, we see so often articles about I wanted to have more kids, or I wish I had started earlier and the like. And that's something that obviously is, you know, boosted a lot of people trying to get fertility treatments and other things. There are other ways around that, of course, but there, that does seem to be an element that we hear both from, you know, feminists, some people, you know, and then traditionalist conservatives as well. How can we change that dynamic?
You know, it's really interesting because there's so much involved, you know, in that question. There are not as many, there haven't been in the past. I think it's changing, but it's not where it needs to be yet. There is not much encouragement in the workforce, in the workplace, for men to help women elevate and get to that next level. Men can often be so helpful in supporting women as they are moving more into managerial, you know, positions, and they haven't necessarily done that. Now, I'm not blaming men for that, but women sometimes need a little, you know, wind beneath their wings to try and get to those next levels. But at the same time, then if women are the ones who have to leave to go pick up children at daycare, if they're the ones who have to leave the job to go do that, and a man doesn't have to do that, then there it's almost you're penalized for having done that because you can't be there till the 7, 8, 9 o'clock time to work at night when perhaps a man or someone else, you know, could be there doing that. So you get penalized for that. And what I have found, though, recently, which I find encouraging, is that women are at a greater percentage now getting higher degrees at universities than the men are. But the downside of that is a lot of women who will major in engineering or in data analytics, et cetera, when they come out, they don't go to work in their field because that opening is not as available to them. So they also need to have the courage to step in and to make sure that they are in the field where they can advance, you know, in their own field. And I do think that just, you know, women in the workforce, I do believe in equal pay for equal work. I certainly do believe in that. But when you're judged a little bit of, well, okay, equal pay, but this person worked another 2 hours during the day and they're not getting overtime because they didn't have to leave and go home, that's just unfair. So I think the fact that not only women but men both can work a bit from home now, that that's more in the workplace of being a bit more understanding. Mm-hmm. I have seen also in my own company, you know, that there are times, periods during the day where women were allowed to leave or men either and go to a school activity or take a child to a doctor or whatever and come back. So I think that the workplace itself is being a little bit more flexible to allow that. And I think that's really, you know, where it'll come down to the most. You will attract and retain employees to stay with you if you treat them fairly. And if you have their understanding for what it is they need to do, whether it's male or female. And so trying to penalize one for having to leave early, well, they might could stay later that day, or you don't know about the 4 hours they worked on Saturday. So I just think it's more and more understanding, you know, in the workplace for, especially for women, because when women do leave to have children, often they are then out of the workplace if they're going to have more than one for multiple years, let's say 2 to 5 years. Well, how much has the dynamic in the workplace changed? They almost have to reskill and reeducate to come back to work, and they've missed time. Mm-hmm. And so that's an unfair advantage.
It really does seem like you're talking about something that's a cultural change.
It really is a cultural change, more than anything else. More than anything else, I think it is a cultural change because to try to legislate that, mm-hmm, just really doesn't work because each working environment is different. There are some companies that can be more flexible than others. I mean, if you have a company and a woman is on an assembly line and she has to be there and it's, you know, it's X number of hours and you have to be doing this amount of work, then perhaps there's a flexibility of the total hours that get worked that week, or you'll have a weekend shift or an earlier morning or later night shift. And I think there are just ways that culturally we have to look at that to be accommodating to our women, but also, you know, to other employees. But I think especially women are hit harder, you know, by those things.
Linda McMahon, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join me today. Yeah, great to talk to you.
Thanks, Ben. I really appreciate it.
I wanted to share with you briefly a couple of thoughts that I had about the developments related to the potential assassination attempt of Brett Kavanaugh. This looks to have been very real in a way that a lot of things that are sort of in this same space are not as real. You think, for instance, of the attempt to kidnap Gretchen Whitmer, which turned out to mostly be an FBI-created, federally created plot, not something that was ever really going to get off the ground. In this case, a gentleman decided to target Brett Kavanaugh. After reading a lot of different things online, he was able to determine where Kavanaugh lived. He showed up there armed, ready to essentially try to kidnap him, kill him, potentially kidnap and kill his family as well, and then said that he planned to kill himself afterwards. This would be major front page news if it was about any left of center justice, certainly in any other context regarding another decision. But because Kavanaugh is so personally reviled in Washington, the coverage that this has received has been shockingly little. The New York Times had a small note about it on its front page and a small story about it in the interior. It was ignored by a number of major media publications and networks. Essentially, it's something that if you don't pay attention to Fox or to right-of-center publications or to those heterodox journalists who are out there on places like Substack, you might not have even heard that this happened. In fact, there were protesters that very evening in front of Kavanaugh's house in a scene that was obviously something that did not look good for those opponents of the measure that people believe he is going to push forward with in terms of a Supreme Court opinion on the Dobbs v. Jackson abortion case or in other areas such as gun policy and the like. Kavanaugh is obviously someone who is a lightning rod at the moment, but it's worth remembering this was not always the case. He was viewed, frankly, as almost a consensus choice in a number of different ways. He wasn't even on the initial Donald Trump selection list that was put forward during the 2016 campaign. He was a later addition to it. And part of that had to do with the fact that he was viewed as fairly establishment, fairly within the mainstream of Washington Republican hierarchies, perhaps less of an outside choice. Going back and looking, of course, at those hearings that turned so crazy in so many different ways, the testimony from Christine Blasey Ford, the accusations from the now disgraced Michael Avenatti and others, this was a scenario that really went off the rails in a significant way and ended up having a number of ramifications when it came to the ballot box. A lot of Republicans look back on it as being a moment that radicalized them in certain ways because of the way that Kavanaugh was treated. That even though when people looked at him from the left, they saw someone who they disliked, he reminded a lot of Republicans of an upstanding dad who just wanted to be able to coach his daughter's basketball team. At the end of the day, this is the kind of situation that we wanted to avoid in America because of how much it injects the toxicity that inhabits our political life at the moment into every aspect of our lives, meaning that people can't disagree, have a fight, go through the process electorally, and then come out at the end believing that they either won or lost fairly, and then have the experience of not being accosted when they go into public, of not being, you know, pulled away from their family when they're out at a restaurant and the like. That's something that changed in the course of recent years. I remember its early developments and how much it's gotten worse. It's something that overwhelmingly comes from the left in terms of this attitude toward public confrontation that they have. It always makes them look worse, from my perspective, and never really abounds to any kind of benefit. The attempts that they have made at fear-mongering, particularly from Senator Chuck Schumer, have now turned on in a more divisive and even more troubling way into very real threats on the lives of these justices. It's why it's so important for this decision to be released soon, to be able to hear what the court has ultimately decided, and to have the clarification of it. But I do think that incidents like this are inevitably going to result in an increase in threats toward the people who make these culture war decisions in our lives. There's always a push that happens, and then there's a bit of a backlash. There was certainly some backlash after the attempted shooting of Steve Scalise and a number of other Republican members of Congress when they were practicing for their baseball game that many years ago. In a shooting in Alexandria that was very disturbing for a lot of reasons and obviously came close to killing Steve Scalise. But that's also a situation where I do not see the same denunciation from the White House of this happening that we saw in the immediate from Bernie Sanders, who went down to the Senate floor when it became clear that the shooter in this question was one of his supporters, and decried it, spoke against it, made clear his opposition to such things. And that's something that I think is important. The fact that this White House has been so slow in condemning this uptick of attacks and potentially even assassination attempts against a Supreme Court justice is absolutely abhorrent. It's embarrassing. I can't imagine that this would be working out the same way if the ideologies were flipped around. And I believe it's very irresponsible for the president to go on Jimmy Kimmel and make light of this situation or suggest that if these justices find in the way that they already are indicated, that there is going to be a mini revolution to remove people from office in reaction to it. The court needs to be able to do its work. It needs to be able to do its work in a timely manner without the insistence of partisan political interventions or these types of leaks that have come out of it or these types of threats that have been arrayed against him. That is not the way that a system of government can function if it continues in the long term. And it's going to take voices on the left standing up in condemnation of this in order for things to change. I'm Ben Domenech. You've been listening to another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast. We will be back soon with more to dive back into the fray.
The Fox News Rundown, a contrast of perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. Your daily dose of news twice a day, featuring insight from top newsmakers, reporters, and Fox News contributors. Listen and subscribe now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.